With Montana News, I'm Mary Auld. This afternoon, we're hearing from the candidates for state auditor. Troy Downing is the Republican candidate for the job, which oversees the insurance and investment industries. He spoke with Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney about consumer protection, promoting choice in the insurance industry, and multiple use on state trust lands.
Troy Downing is the Republican candidate for state auditor. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. I appreciate it.
For voters who aren't familiar with you and your candidacy, can you please give us a brief introduction?
Yeah, I started out in education. I was a research scientist in the Courant Institute of Mathematical Sciences, and I taught at NYU. I left there to do a startup company that I merged with Yahoo in the 90s. And after that, I started helping other people do the same thing, basically doing angel financing and mentorship of startup companies, helping other people build companies where there was nothing. And had some success there and had some failures there and learned a lot. And eventually I got to a point in my life where I was just done with technology, from the research position, the teaching position, dealing with startup companies and mentoring startup companies and funding startup companies. And I just needed to do something different. And something that I noticed is that most people that I knew that had multi-generational wealth all had some sort of a real estate play. And that really caught my attention. And so I started dabbling in commercial real estate, all different flavors, from multifamily to land entitlement to vacation rentals. And I eventually stumbled upon somebody looking for an investment in a self-storage deal. And it's something that I'd never thought about before, but I really liked, the fundamentals on how that business worked. And so I invested in a few of those and then started consulting and eventually syndicating my own deals and started raising money through the independent broker-dealer networks. And basically, those are, the wealth managers, financial advisors that, have retail clients that they make investments for. And so we did a broker-dealer deal, and we're wholesaling that to these retail broker-dealers around the country, and had some success and built a pretty large portfolio. And somewhere along the way there, we saw an opportunity to self-insure and started looking at that, doing our own P&C, our property and casualty, and then saw something that was even more interesting, and that was an opportunity to put together a program for self-storage tenants so that they could insure their contents while they were in storage. And originally we did that for our own portfolio, and then eventually we turned that into a third-party program and started selling that to independent operators, and became a fairly large company. It's a national company. It is a program manager for basically the third largest storage real estate investment trust in the world. So there's been some success there, and it currently insures, I don't know the exact number, but it's in the hundreds of thousands of insureds under that program. So that's kind of been my professional journey, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, but I think it's very relevant to the office that I'm running for. I'm running for the Commissioner of Insurance and the Commissioner of Securities, and I have a securities background. I've been licensed under FINRA. We've wholesaled Reg D offerings, so securities offerings through the broker-dealer networks, and I've built a nationwide insurance company. One other thing I just want to throw in is, the timeline doesn't always make sense to people when they hear about my story, but somewhere in the middle there between the technology and the commercial real estate, securities, and insurance part was September 11th, and that was also a big chapter in my life. Because when we had the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, I was deeply affected. Growing up in a poor family and having the kind of success that I did, I just had a need to feel like I deserved all the opportunities that I had in my life as an American. And I walked into a recruiter's office after September 11th, and at 34 years old, got sworn into a combat search and rescue squadron, and ended up doing a couple of tours to Afghanistan. There's a couple of kind of fun stories in there too. Like, I got deployed to Afghanistan in 2005 in the middle of doing a self-storage deal, and they actually had to FedEx purchase and sale documents out to Kandahar so I could get wedding signatures, but a little bit of an anomaly there. But, you know, the basic premise is, you know, my background comes from education. I've got, you know, fairly broad business background, and I've worked in both the insurance and the securities industries, which I believe are incredibly relevant to the office that I'm running for.
And now looking for another change in profession, you talked about working in technology and insurance and real estate. In 2018, you sought the Republican Party's nomination to run for the U.S. Senate. You're now looking for the job as Commissioner of Securities and Insurance in the state of Montana, state auditor. Why jump into politics? What's your ambition there?
Well, you know, people ask me the same thing when I walked into a recruiter's office. They said, why are you doing this? You know, you don't need a job. Why are you doing this? And the answer has always been the same. You know, I feel an incredible need to give back. I have a personal need, again, like I said before, to feel that I deserve all the opportunities and the benefits that I've, you know, taken advantage of just being an American. And after September 11th, that was a pretty clear path. And then I saw, you know, a different opportunity to serve. And as you mentioned, I ran for U.S. Senate, and that did not work out for me in that race. And after that, I was looking at this auditor's position, and I thought, what a great opportunity to use my experience to once again serve and do good. I think this is an office that's incredibly meaningful. It affects everybody in the state. I think it's important that you have somebody that understands the industry. And that's on two sides. There's two reasons for that. One is, you know, this is first and foremost, this is primarily a consumer protection agency. It's there to protect consumers, to make sure that they're protected from bad actors, from those who would mislead or defraud or, you know, harm consumers. And having industry experience, you see how people can game the system, how they can take advantage of the unsuspecting, how they can, you know, harm consumers. And so I think it's really important to have that industry experience to be able to better protect the consumer, which is the, you know, fundamental reason this office exists.
You've talked about wanting to protect Montana consumers. That's something you've said on the campaign trail. You've also said you want to drive down costs for health insurance and prescription drug prices. Hopefully we can touch on each of those points, but starting out with consumer protection, what specific policies do you want to see additional ground made if elected?
Well, you know, first of all, making sure that we are watching out for, you know, very egregious acts. You know, and you see a lot of those in the securities industry, making sure that we are watching and have, you know, a hotline and people to deal with somebody who would mislead an investor, somebody investing their retirement dollars, or, you know, somebody trusting you to do something, making sure that we are identifying and coming down hard on those actors. On the insurance side, making sure that our insurance companies are doing exactly what they're required to do, making sure that they are towing the line in what's expected both in statute and by contract. That policy is a contract, and making sure that they're not short paying, slow paying, you know, watching that that industry very closely.
Do you have additional policies you want to see put in place to make sure those companies are being watched appropriately?
Right now, it's just boots on the ground. It's making sure that somebody's answering the phone. It's making sure that we have the legal staff to pursue and prosecute. I think it's making sure that we have the resources to do that.
Does that mean you think the office right now isn't currently staffed appropriately and needs more staff?
I think that there is some opportunity. I believe that the legal staff, that they've had a couple of openings come up there, and I think it's important that we have that division of the department very well staffed, and that's something that I'll be working on. In terms of people just on the policy, the people that are handling the phone calls for dealing with policy questions and issues and complaints, you know, I need to look at that a little bit more closely, but I will make sure that nobody's, you know, getting a busy signal when they try to, you know, get a hold of the office.
And when you've talked about wanting to be a consumer advocate, I've also seen in some of your campaign statements that you also want to be someone who advocates for businesses and make Montana more pro-business in the state. And I'm wondering, you know, wanting to be an advocate for businesses and consumer protection, you know, if these two interests, you know, come to a head, how do you decide, you know, when to be pro-business, when to be consumer protection? How do you decide who to decide with and if that comes to a head?
Well, there's not a decision to be made there. I mean, the decision is clear. This office exists to protect the consumer. So if there's ambiguity, this office exists to protect the consumer. But on the other part, I think it's important to note that being pro-business and helping businesses operate in these industries in Montana is consumer advocacy. If we can remove barriers to make it easier for insurance companies to operate in Montana, if we can make it so that there's more competition, that starts to create more opportunity, more options for the consumer. That also starts to push prices down. Competition almost always pushes down prices. So I think there's ways that you can look at the code and look at this holistically and say, what parts of the regulatory code, you know, are clearly protecting consumers? What parts of the code are just making it difficult to do business in Montana? And if you look at somebody interested in setting up shop in Montana, let's say we're talking about an insurance company, and they look at the state, you know, we've got, you know, an incredible amount of geography, we've got a relatively small population, and they may decide that it makes sense to start their business there, or it may, you know, not make sense. But then we throw in another hiccup and say, by the way, we're going to do it a little bit differently than everywhere else you do. So now you've got to make another decision on, do I want to hire another compliance, you know, department or another, you know, more compliance people? Do I want to start learning a new set of rules to do something different here than we're doing everywhere else that we do business? I think really identifying the stuff that makes it more difficult to set up shop that's disadvantageous to the consumer. So one of the things that I want to do is not only just look at the code on what is just creating paperwork that has no reasonable expectation of consumer protection and start getting rid of that. And then the other thing is I think we need to really look closely at administrative rules and make sure that the office is not trying to, you know, legislate or create statute through a tool that's really meant for disambiguating. You know, administrative rules, in my opinion, are, you know, there to create clarity where there's lack of clarity in statute, but not to actually create statute. And by having really clean regulation, I think it's easier for a business owner to say, here's the rules, here's the line, I understand it's always going to be there, this is how I'm going to run my business. It makes it a lot easier, and the easier we make it, the more opportunities and the better pricing we're going to have for consumers. So I do believe that is consumer advocacy.
And do you have specific regulations in mind now that if elected, they would be some of your first to remove?
Well, you know, I think that on the insurance side, we need to look really closely at making sure that we are allowing insurance companies to price to actuarial reality. And there's certain instances where we don't do that. The one that I think is coming up the most is we don't differentiate between the risks of a male versus a female. You know, we have these unisex laws. And so I think that creates a disadvantage for insurers trying to price, because they end up having to price higher than the actual risk of those policies. I think we need to look at that. You know, there's some really simple things on the health side of just having different sets of forms that, you know, that these health insurance companies are using elsewhere in the country. So why are we doing that? Let's start looking at these barriers and understanding, really, is that creating protection, or is it just creating a roadblock, or is that just creating a situation where government statute is picking winners and losers in an industry? And if that's the case, let's start cleaning that up and make it easier to do business here.
So under your proposal, then, gender couldn't be considered a factor in adjusting insurance rates?
Just the opposite. Right now, you're not allowed to. We have unisex laws, so that the risk of a woman and a risk of a man, which are different risks, you know, there's some actuarial reality there, have to be priced the same. And I don't believe that's correct.
Could that possibly be challenged by gender discrimination laws?
You know, I think you can challenge anything, just like, you know, there's always somebody that'll find a reason to challenge anything. But really what it comes down to is the actual risk, is there actuarial reality? Is it being priced appropriately based on the actual risk? And I believe that that's important. You know, if you live in a flood zone, it should be more expensive to buy flood insurance because the risk is different. And in business, I think, and especially in insurance, I think that you should be able to price to the actual risk without creating these, you know, artificial blinders that, you know, keep the reality of the risk away from you.
Want to touch on a few other issues your campaign has made, along with having a position of wanting to be pro-business and a consumer advocate. You've talked about wanting to drive down the cost of health insurance and prescription drug prices. How exactly would you plan to do that?
Well, first of all, in this office, I really want to champion transparency. And I think that just the simple act of understanding where your premium dollars are going, where your money being spent is going, what kind of benefit you're getting from it, you know, starts to create pressures on change. And I think that, you know, there's a couple of things that we need to look at. We need to look at how Big Pharma is pricing prescription drugs, and why we see these discrepancies of, you know, why is insulin so expensive in Montana and so cheap across the border, or the same thing with epinephrine. Let's start really shining the light on transparency to Big Pharma, and let's start, you know, asking questions of, you know, what did it cost to produce? You know, what did it cost? What did you actually sell this for? And have them in a position where they have to explain that. And I understand, you know, there's other costs involved with research and development. I actually, you know, briefly did some research for Merck years and years and years ago. And so I understand what goes into the research and development. But the other part, and this is where I think we open that window in having a claim to start, you know, making these demands, is that, you know, there's a lot of taxpayer, you know, subsidies on research and development. So we can, I think it's reasonable for us to, you know, ask the question, if we're going to, you know, be subsidizing this, if the United States of America is paying to subsidize research and development, the least we can do is ask for transparency in what it's costing to produce and what you're actually selling it for. I think another part that we can look at is in pharmacy benefit managers. You know, what value are they bringing to the consumer? And is that value something that has an upward or downward pressure on their premiums? What kind of, you know, incentives and kickbacks are they getting from the pharma companies for, you know, hitting certain metrics on producing? Is that something that is increasing or reducing the insurance costs? You know, almost a third of what Blue Cross is paying in their payments in handling health claims is going to pharma. So let's start looking at that. The first thing I think is transparency. You know, another thing is I want to start seeing transparency in hospital billing practices. I think people should understand, you know, how and why they're being charged for what they're charged. Does it have anything to do with the reality of the cost or value of goods or services? You know, what am I getting as an uninsured versus, you know, a contractual relationship to pay a different amount to somebody else? I think we should start asking these kinds of questions and create some transparency there. I think we can go a long way.
Transparency in healthcare costs, prescription drug prices, this is something that's been talked at the state level, at the national level for many years now. What specific policies are you going to propose if elected? Is there, specific bills you want to see in the next legislative session that'll get this done?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there were some issues, and I don't want to, you know, comment on it as written, but we saw Senate Bill 71, pass the legislature last session, and it got vetoed.
And for some context there, Senate Bill 71 was proposed by the current state auditor, Matt Rosendale, on pharmacy benefit manager regulations and insurance company regulations.
Yes, and I think, I've been talking to a lot of the stakeholders on that, on, you know, what was good about it, what was not good about it. And so we're looking at that pretty closely. I know that there's a couple of alternatives coming out again for, you know, registration of PSAOs, of the organizations that are managing those, of the PBMs, of having pharma registration, and we're looking really closely at that. I don't want to go on the record saying that, you know, my agency is going to support Senate Bill 71 as written, but I think that something along those lines that is more general. You know, the arguments that I'm hearing against Senate Bill 71 is that it actually affected a very small part of the market. But I think something that has a more general net so that we really do see the whole picture is something that, that my agency will support.
And, you know, besides Senate Bill 71, are there additional, you know, maybe new policies you'd want to see put in place for either, you know, those goals you have of lowering healthcare costs or providing transparency to those healthcare costs? You've talked about transparency, but how do you lower the costs?
Yeah, well, you know, there's obviously, as I've already said, I believe that once you shine a light, you know, people are more informed and they start asking the right questions. You know, we're looking at some certificate of need laws, which, you know, we believe are contrary to fair competition. And so we're looking pretty closely at that. We are also pretty I think the one thing that we've seen in this COVID pandemic is the value of telemedicine. I think we're looking at expanding that. It's obviously had a real strong and positive place during this pandemic. We're looking at you know, a number of things just to try to, you know, like I said, understand who's doing what in the state, and that. Coupled with my plan on putting together educational materials, I think really gives the tools to start understanding, you know, what we're getting for our premium dollars, who's getting paid what, and what kind of benefit we're getting. You know, another big part of what I want to see in this agency, you know, is consumer education. And when we're talking about the insurance side, I want to start creating, you know, resources and educational documents so that a consumer understands what they're getting and what they're not getting. And, you know, I get a little bit of criticism for this sometimes, but I think it's fundamentally American to have, you know, options. And a lot of people will say, well, are you going to support, you know, direct primary care? Are you going to support, you know, healthcare sharing ministries? And my short answer is yes. I think that having choices, having tools in your toolbox is meaningful. It gives you choices, it gives you options. But the way you mitigate, you know, some of the issues that you may have is producing educational materials and resources and references so that a consumer can say, well, is traditional Blue Cross appropriate for me and my family, or is direct primary care a better option, and why?
And just for a little bit of additional context here, when you talk about bringing more options into the insurance market, this is something that current auditor Matt Rosendale has also encouraged. You talked about ministry plans or short-term insurance plans. And the trade-off, you mentioned the criticism, is that the short-term plans are definitely much cheaper. They don't offer the same coverage as traditional health plans, meaning they don't cover pre-existing conditions and can lead to higher out-of-pocket costs. So it does create more options. And why is that trade-off, allowing more options, you know, a better option for the consumer?
Well, because we're all different. And me and my family's needs are probably different than you and your family's needs, which is different than, you know, it's hard to delineate of, you know, one size fits all. It comes back to, you know, I said having a lot of tools in the toolbox. I don't want to just have a hammer, but what I want to do is produce reference material. So if you're trying to decide what's appropriate for you, what's appropriate for your family, you have a place to look and say, well, what are the risks in taking option A versus option B? What are the costs? What am I giving up? What questions should I ask? So having those kinds of materials so that a person who chooses to do so can educate themselves, because some of them are going to be service driven, some are going to be price driven, some are going to be, you know, somewhere in between. But I think having those options, again, is better overall, because there's a competitive market and different things for them to do. I think the important part in allowing those options is not for the government to take that choice away from you, but for my office, for the auditor's office, to give you the resources you need to make an intelligent decision on which one is really appropriate for your very specific, you know, situation. I don't think that that the government should be telling somebody that they have to do, you know, one option over another. I think that you should be able to make those choices for yourself.
Want to jump topics to another responsibility of the state auditor outside of the insurance and securities industries. State auditor is one of the five statewide elected officials who sits on the state land board, which manages state trust lands. If you're elected, you sit on this board. What would be some of your priorities for managing these lands?
Well, one thing that's interesting about the land board is it's you know, a lot of people misunderstand what exactly it is. And you gave a brief synopsis, but it was constitutionally created to manage state trust lands to fund public education. And the way we do that is through leases, through grazing leases, through ag leases, through timber extraction, through natural resource development, all the things that we do with our land. And first and foremost, you know, we all look out our windows. I'm looking out my window right now at Spanish Peaks Foothills. And we smile, and we need to make sure that we always look out our windows and smile, and we keep that, you know, in the front of our thoughts when we're making decisions. So when I'm thinking about, you know, dealing with, you know, public lands in particular, in general, and these state trust lands in particular, is the idea of multiple use and sustained yield. And a lot of people want to say that multiple use, you know, means different things. It means my use, or it means not your use, or it needs some specific use. But I think we need to look at all of this holistically and say, first of all, you know, let's make sure we're not destroying anything, make sure that we're always looking out there and smiling, make sure we're truly stewards. But where does it make sense to graze cattle? Where does it make sense to deal with access issues? We all care about access. How do you negotiate or mediate conversations with differing interests, you know, like property, you know, private property rights versus, you know, the public's right to access public lands? How do you mitigate these things? Where does it make sense to harvest timber? Where does it make sense to do all these things that we do with our land? And then the second part of that is equally, if not more important, and that's the sustained yield. And so what that means to me is make these decisions in a way that you can do this forever, that you don't deplete the asset, don't give in to short-term windfall in exchange for long-term sustainability. So as we're making these decisions, make sure that we're not, you know, grazing to scorched earth, that we're not, you know, harvesting timber to the point where we, you know, forests are no longer viable. Let's make sure that all the decisions we make are with a long-term goal, because it's easy to get caught up in that idea of, you know, you're trying to maximize income to fund public education, and you may have opportunity for, you know, big short-term windfall. Always have that long horizon in your mind so that, you know, not just us, but our kids and our grandkids and future generations still look out their windows and smile and still have the ability to use these, you know, these treasures that we've been entrusted with. And the other part of that that is incredibly important is, you know, that's money that's going to public education. And it's a small percentage of the overall educational budget, but it's still a relatively large check. Last year was about $46 million. And if we're not doing what these specific school sections were set aside to do, and we're not maintaining and growing that, we don't have a lot of good options for fixing a shortfall there. I mean, one option is cutting services, and I'm sure most of your listeners know that there, we don't have much room for cutting services. I mean, that'd be devastating to certain schools around the in school districts around the state. But your other tools are mill levies on property taxes or income tax, and we've already got property taxes, you know, the people are, Montanans are struggling to pay. We just don't have a lot of options if we're not doing what the Board of Land Commissioners was specifically created to do.
I want to touch on what you said about multiple use there. There are, you know, lots of, or there could be lots of different ideals for how public land is used. And, you know, a cattle rancher might have a separate idea from, you know, someone who can look out their window and see the Spanish Peaks and smile is probably different from someone who has maybe an apartment in downtown Billings. And so, you know, where do you come from and what are your priorities as an individual for managing these lands? And what, you know, when we talk about multiple use, what uses do you see as kind of, you know, the focus if you were elected?
Well, when you start talking about public lands in general, obviously you have a lot of very different ideas on what that means. And, you know, just talking on, you know, BLM land, I personally have spent, you know, countless volunteer hours and dollars out there, you know, swinging axes and shovels, building mountain bike trails on BLM land. I mean, that's stuff that's important to me personally. But in terms of my role on the Board of Land Commissioners, you know, one of the things that is a central theme of my campaign and has been a central theme of my life is communication, is talking to everybody that has differing opinions on this, because you're not always going to see eye to eye. Sometimes you're going to butt heads, but through having these conversations, you hopefully start to understand, you know, where the reality between, you know, two competing ideas are. And so one of the things that I've done that I'm particularly proud of is I've put together the starts of an advisory board for dealing with public land issues, or actually more specifically, state trust land issues. And so I found people from industry, like from, you know, from the ranching industry, from the farming industry, from the mining industry, from the logging industry. But I've also got folks from the outfitting and guide industry. I've got folks from the, you know, outdoor recreation industry. I've got members of school boards. And my goal in this is to foster conversation on how we solve problems and making sure that everybody that has a stake in this has a seat at the table. Even though, you know, school board members aren't necessarily, you know, the direct users of these state trust lands, they are beneficiaries. I think they should have a seat at the table. But so what this allows me to do is it gives them a place to bring things up to me. But more importantly, when something comes down on the agenda, I have a group of people to talk to that are affected by these decisions. So I can say, how does this affect you? How can we make it better? What are the intended consequences? All these things, so you can have a meaningful conversation about making decisions on what you do with all these very disparate, you know, school sections. I mean, you know, we've got a school section in Kalispell with a Costco on it. So that's going to have very different issues than somebody that's, you know, grazing cattle outside of Miles City. So we need to have, you know, a lot of stakeholders with a lot of different views there to have these respectful, meaningful conversations to solve some difficult problems. And that's something that I'm pretty excited about doing. Because the last thing that I want to do in this office, you know, I'm somebody that rolls up my sleeves and gets to work. And I want to make sure when I roll into this office that I don't have somebody that's been dealing with the land board for 20 years to come and tell me what I'm supposed to care about. I want to lean on the actual stakeholders, from, you know, recreational users to ranchers and loggers and everybody in between, and understand how we can make things better with that long-term stewardship in mind, and continue to satisfy the mandate of raising money to fund public education.
Are there other issues that are important to your campaign that we haven't touched on that you think voters should know about?
You know, I think really the central theme here is this office oversees two large, complicated, highly regulated industries that touch almost every Montanan. And it's also, as we just talked about, you know, a land board seat that affects everybody in the state as well. And I think it's really important, both on a consumer protection side and on a industry streamlining, industry supporting side, which, you know, as I mentioned, I believe is still consumer advocacy, to have somebody that has experience. I think having some broad business experience is meaningful. I think having industry experience is particularly meaningful. You know, I worry about somebody that has none of the above, no business experience, no industry experience, simply not knowing what they don't know. I mean, that just smells of a political figurehead and not somebody that actually rolls up their sleeves and does the job. And if I wanted to just talk about, you know, the central themes, and I know we've mentioned this before, you know, I think transparency is a big deal. I think education is a tremendous deal. And those are two things that I really want to push. And cleaning up the regulatory code so that we are focused on that consumer protection side while making it easier for businesses to do business in Montana. And just one other thing that is, you know, kind of in my bailiwick that I also want to see, and this goes along with the education side, because we talked about creating products and resources for consumers to, you know, vet their insurance choices and other things like that. But, you know, another part of this is capital creation of helping Montana business owners or would-be business owners or Montana entrepreneurs understand how to raise money to build businesses. You've got this dream of building a restaurant or a car wash or a whatever it is, whatever your business is, and understanding, you know, what the opportunities are for you to raise money from investors. I think that that solves so many problems in helping build Montana businesses, create Montana jobs. You know, that's another big part of what I want to push on the education side in this office. And I'll tell you, I'm really, really excited about the opportunity. I'm excited about rolling up my sleeves, of getting in there, showing up to work every day, and actually creating some positive, a positive move in these industries that affects everybody in the state. I think there's a lot we can do to protect consumers and create more options and drive prices down and hold big pharma accountable and all those things that fall under the purview of insurance and securities. So I'm excited to do it.
Troy Downing is the Republican candidate for state auditor. He faces Democrat Shane Morgeau and Libertarian Roger Roots. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.